Today is Monday, November the 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Coming up, Democrats and Republicans continue to spar as the U.S. House of Representatives prepares for public hearings in the impeachment inquiry of President Donald Trump.
It's a matter of taking American money that the Congress allocated for foreign aid for a country to withhold it and say to that leader, I'm not going to give it to you unless you do what I need you to do.
Also ahead, firefighters working to contain a 1,000 California wildfire made significant progress by Sunday, containing 50% of the blaze with some help from cooler weather and lighter winds. It's all on today's International Edition. Democrats and Republicans continue to spar as the U.S. House of Representatives prepares for public hearings in the impeachment inquiry of President Donald Trump. VOA's Arash Arbasadi reports from Washington.
Last week, the democratically led House formalized the next steps in the impeachment inquiry consuming Washington.
On this vote, the yeas are 232, the nays are 196. The resolution is adopted without objection. The motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
Democrats say Trump committed an impeachable offense by withholding congressionally approved aid to press Ukraine to investigate a political rival, former Vice President Joe Biden. Biden is seeking the Democratic nomination in the 2020 presidential election.
It's a matter of taking American money that the Congress allocated for foreign aid for a country to withhold it and say to that leader, I'm not going to give it to you unless you do what I need you to do. That is an absolute disgrace, and that's one of the reasons we're here.
Republicans, meanwhile, continued casting doubt on the legitimacy of the investigation led by Democrats that so far has been conducted behind closed doors.
Madam Speaker, when you look through this resolution and you see how one-sided, how Soviet-style this is running, this is the United States of America. Don't run a sham process, a tainted process, like this resolution ensures.
Trump, too, has been far from silent.
The Democrats are crazed. They're lunatics. The impeachment thing is a hoax. Now, whether or not they tried pulling it off, it would be a disgrace.
Dozens of Republicans sit on committees involved in the impeachment probe. But the president's defenders say that's not enough.
They're literally going behind closed doors to deny rights to not only the Republicans and President Trump, but to the American people. There are a lot of questions that haven't been answered. We can't see the transcripts still. I wish those were held in public.
Democrats say Republicans trumpet procedural objections in order to sidestep having to defend Trump's actions.
The Republicans keep moving the goalposts. They tell us they want us to be transparent. When we're transparent, it's not good enough. They can't complain about not having open hearings, and then when we have open hearings, complain about that as well.
The impeachment spectacle will grow in intensity when public televised hearings begin. Arash Arbasadi, VOA News, Washington.
The lawyer to the U.S. official whose whistleblower complaint led to the impeachment inquiry against President Donald Trump has offered to communicate directly with Republicans on the Intelligence Committee leading the inquiry. AP's Tim McGuire reports.
In a tweet, attorney Mark Zaid writes, Congressman Devin Nunes, the top Republican on the House Intelligence Committee, has been approached about the whistleblower answering questions from Republicans in writing. President Trump has demanded the person's identity made public since his call to the president of the Ukraine became public. House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Elliot Engel tells ABC's This Week a key reason for the impeachment inquiry.
Did the president really sell out his country?
But House Republican Whip Steve Scalise, also on ABC's This Week, says the Democrats are playing politics.
They don't want fair rules. They just want to hurt President Trump's chances to win re-election.
Tim McGuire, Washington.
However, as the inquiry enters its sixth week, legal experts doubt that lawmakers leading the inquiry will need the whistleblower testimony to make their case. Congressional investigators have heard firsthand accounts from U.S. officials, including former National Security Council member Alexander Vindman, that describe Trump's efforts to pressure Ukraine to investigate the 2020 Democratic candidate Joe Biden and his son Hunter. Frank O'Bowman III is a professor of law at the University of Missouri School of Law. He is the author of High Crimes and Misdemeanors, A History of Impeachment for the Age of Trump. He tells me that the strategy of focusing on the whistleblower is a diversion.
I think that the Republicans focus on the whistleblower rather than on the underlying facts of the case suggests really that this is something of a diversion. I think it's unlikely that they would be willing to accept even a reasonable compromise because it would deprive them of the ability to use this diversion.
Now, President Trump continues to call for people to identify the whistleblower, and some have said that this amounts to witness intimidation. Do you think that could be used against him in the impeachment proceedings?
Well, I just think it's all part of a larger picture. I don't think that the members of either the Intelligence Committee or ultimately the Judiciary Committee would be disposed to make that a separate article of impeachment, but I think it adds to the larger picture of Mr. Trump and his allies, again, trying to divert attention away from the facts and also repeatedly trying to denigrate witnesses who come forward to talk about his potential misbehavior. It would be much more encouraging, I think, for the American public and for the public of the world if Trump would stop calling names to people who have come forward at some professional risk to describe what occurred and deal instead with what actually occurred.
Mm. So you're saying that the fixation on exposing the whistleblower is because they don't want to deal with the issues. Do you see this as a new strategy to attack the credibility of the whistleblower?
Well, I don't think that's new. I think that was one of the things that Mr. Trump started with and others started with. And Mr. Trump started referring to the whistleblower as a never-Trumper and and calling this person, whoever he or she may be, names long before, and we got the information, the additional information that we're getting on a daily basis. So I think the personal attacks on the people who've been witnesses and may yet be witnesses has always been the essence of Mr. Trump's strategy.
Now, we just learned that through some newly released documents that Trump campaign officials told the FBI that during the 2016 presidential race, the campaign's chairman, Paul Manafort, who is currently in jail, that he pushed the idea that Ukraine and not Russia was behind the hack of the DNC servers. Do you see this information having any bearing on the impeachment inquiry and proceedings?
So far as it suggests some of the origins of Mr. Trump's obsession with Ukraine, it appears from a fairly early point, people around him fostered this conspiracy theory that somehow or other Ukraine was involved in election manipulation. It provides for Mr. Trump and another alternative or other means to do what he's been trying to do since the election, which is to discredit the idea that Russia intervened on behalf of him and against Hillary Clinton. And it gives us some sense of where this obsession with Ukraine may have come from. But the real core of the impeachment inquiry remains what actually transpired between Mr. Trump and the president of Ukraine, and equally importantly, between other American representatives and other Ukrainian representatives, because the overall picture is not just one conversation between Mr. Trump and the president of Ukraine, but instead a long series of contacts in which the entire Trump apparatus tried to extort information or an announcement of an investigation from Ukraine using the leverage of American military and diplomatic support for Ukraine against an expansionist Russia.
That was Frank O'Borman, professor of law at the University of Missouri Law School. He's the author of High Crimes and Misdemeanors, A History of Impeachment for the Age of Trump. Among the top stories in the world, a pro-democracy politician and four other people were injured when a knife-wielding man attacked protesters in Hong Kong Sunday. And Saudi Arabia finally kicked off what could be the world's biggest initial public offering. Oil giant Aramco announced its intentions to list shares on the local stock exchange in Riyadh. The shares are likely to start trading in December. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on voanews.com website on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Firefighters working to contain a Southern California wildfire made significant progress by Sunday, containing 50% of the blaze with some help from cooler weather and lighter winds. The fire has so far destroyed three structures and burned more than 9,400 acres of dry bush and farmland. VOA's Michelle Quinn is in California. She tells me that as it stands, the firefighters have an upper hand on the destructive wildfire.
In California, there's multiple fires being fought. And both in the Southern California, Los Angeles area, and in Northern California. And as of today, most of these fires are pretty much contained. It's really a clean-up, mop-up time right now, and a time to reflect.
Mm. So I saw report that firefighters made significant headway. What are they doing to fight these fires?
Well, it's interesting because this is the third year in a row, especially in Northern California, where there's been autumn fires caused by wind and spark. And the firefighters in the state have really changed how they fight it. One thing they did, which has never happened before, is the electric company just automatically just turns off the electricity for everybody because the electric company is afraid of itself sparking a fire. And so that was a big change. So far in all these fires, no one has died, particularly in Northern California. In prior years, more buildings and more people have died. So firefighters, have adjusted their strategy. Instead of going directly to the flame, apparently they're kind of creating a wide swath and coming up with a plan for how the fire moves. There's other things they've done as well.
And how many people have been affected by these fires so far this year?
Well, it's really interesting because the fires themselves, maybe 30, 40,000 people have been evacuated or maybe a little bit more from the fires. But what's changed this year is the electric company turned off power to at least a million homes. And that's where it really started to affect people. People who live in urban areas who've never had a power outage suddenly looking at buying generators.
How does the turning off electricity, how is that an effective strategy in fighting these fires?
Well, it's a controversial strategy, so I should be careful about giving the electric company too much or power company too much credit because a lot of people here are angry about it. Mm. But what they've been blamed for in the past 2 years is having lines that were sparking because wind will come, the lines will begin to spark, and then that spark will set a little fire going. But because of the wind and the extreme dryness in California this time of year is totally normal. Mm. We normally don't get rain until maybe the end of November, and then it rains until May, and then we don't get rain for the second half of the year. But the winds have been kind of a new element here, and so the fire company is saying, hey, we don't want to be blamed anymore for starting a fire, so we're just going to we get these weather reports, we're just going to turn off the electricity in these areas, wide swaths. And of course, it really hurts elderly, people with health conditions, poor people. It's a huge burden for people to live without electricity all of a sudden.
Right. So the vulnerable communities will be hurt, especially
exactly.
Also because they don't have any backup plans on
whether it's the generators or moving to other places. Let me ask you real quick. President Donald Trump threatened to withhold aid from California, saying that Governor Gavin Newsom had, quote, done a terrible job of forest management. Who is in charge of these states' forests? Is this the state or the federal government?
It's a really good question. And there's a back and forth between the state of California and our governor, Gavin Newsom, and President Donald Trump about forest management. And I think that, you know, maybe there's a kernel of truth in both of them, but I think that both, there's huge amounts of federal land here. So the federal government is an important player here in California in terms of land management, but the state as well. And I think that I saw the governor say that the president is incorrect, that a lot of these fires were not in wildfire area. It wasn't about fuel that's just being left around. But I don't know that for a fact. I don't know what the truth is. But there is a power struggle going on between the federal government and the state over how do we think about the place we live differently. Do we just clear more? Do we live among nature more, which was a California way of living? And I think people are questioning how much neighborhoods should be in nature. President Trump kind of put his finger on that issue of kind of making the environment safer for people to live in rather than kind of enjoy nature. Mm. But I don't know the truth of either. Both of them kind of are in a Twitter war over this issue.
That was VOA's Michelle Quinn. She was speaking to me earlier this evening from Southern California. Next week marks the 30th year that has passed since the fall of the Berlin Wall, a historic event that led to the end of the divide between the communist East and the democratic West Germany. The wall's demise also symbolized the eventual liberation of East Germany and later the rest of Eastern Europe from Soviet communist rule. So, what was the significance of this event and what are some of the lasting impact on the region 30 years later? For that, International Edition's Steve Miller asked Joanna Schuster-Craig, Assistant Professor of German and Global Studies at Michigan State University.
You know, that happened at multiple levels. So the immediate impact is that some families were separated and split in half. There had been a joint German Olympic team between East and West, which is a little known fact that a lot of people don't know. They competed under the same team and under the same citizenship category. That was no longer an option after the border was secured. And primarily, you had a lot of people in East Germany that had actually been commuting to the West for work and then coming back home to the East to be with their families. And that source of manpower was also cut off. Not only did Eastern Germans lose their jobs because they couldn't get to them, but the West lost a critical source of manpower. And so the construction of the Berlin Wall didn't just affect East Germans by keeping people in the East. It also affected the ability of West Germans to staff jobs, staff factories, and one of the effects was that is that the West started turning more and more to guest worker labor, which significantly also changed the identity of West Germany for the future.
Going back to the families, because my personal history is that I was a correspondent in Seoul, South Korea for a number of years, and they deal with the separation of families between North and South Korea after the end of the Korean War. How did families in Berlin and in Germany deal with that kind of separation?
I think every family was different. As time progressed, West families could get travel waivers to come into the East and sometimes would bring consumer goods from the West to their families in the East. But if you look at the pictures of what the construction looked like, you know, we think of now the Berlin Wall as these huge slabs of concrete, and we think of it in its advanced state. But in the beginning, it was boarded up houses and barbed wire fence and structures that were simply patrolled and securing the border. So you do have some dramatic scenes in 1961 when the wall goes up of people jumping out of windows or soldiers defecting by jumping over the barbed wire fence. Konrad Schumann has a memorial up in the Bernauer Straße in Berlin because he was one of the soldiers that jumped the fence in uniform. But I think mostly what you had was simply East German families being cut off from relatives for decades.
Fast forward to 30 years, we're coming up on the anniversary of the wall coming down. What was the significance in 1989 of that wall coming down and essentially reuniting the two halves of the city?
It was the end of the Cold War. It was the end of communism as a second world system. And so in that sense, it's a global event. The global event of the fall of the wall is something that I try to impress upon my students, because any global event that's of that much importance that causes massive shifts in society is contested. So there's the narrative of East Germans who had organized and come together politically to fight for a democratic regime change and the end of communism. That's one part of the narrative. But then there's also the counter-narrative, where some people are very critical of what happened in the peaceful revolution and see reunification not necessarily as just a positive thing, but as a positive thing that also just opened up Eastern Europe for capitalist economic exploitation. So the fall of the wall is something that we commemorate, that certainly has a prominent place in West German history and East German history and the history of reunified Germany, but there's no master narrative that can tell us, oh, this was a perfect event, this was a wonderful event. It was a complex event, and it had different effects on different groups of people.
So what are some of those effects that have been long-lasting as we move essentially a generation past the fall of the wall?
This is something that's quite interesting to me. So the Berlin Institute for Population and Development published a really interesting study in 2015, and the subtitle of this study was called How Divided Germany Has Grown Together. And one of the things they did in this study was to take data that they had collected, quantitative data, and then visualize it in the form of German maps. And what emerged is that you could still see the division. You could still see in the colored maps that they produced the differences between East and West that persist after a generation. And some of those things are obvious, perhaps. There's less purchasing power for high-end goods in the East, and there's more acceptance of immigrants in the West because there are more immigrants in the West. But one of the things that's super interesting is that because the infrastructure in East Germany wasn't so great, East Germans actually use renewable energy sources 9 percentage points more than West Germans do now.
Well, that's
they also have a higher rate of coal usage, but there's that mixed picture.
That was Joanna Schuster-Craig, assistant professor of German and Global Studies at Michigan State University. She was speaking to International Edition's Steve Miller. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. The United Nations and human rights defenders are calling for greater protection for journalists as the world observes this year's International Day to end impunity for crimes against journalists. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the UN's European headquarters in Geneva.
The gruesome murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul last year is a textbook case of impunity. The Saudi Arabian assassins and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who allegedly commissioned the killing, have paid no price for this crime. Many other killings of journalists also go unpunished. In his message on this International Day, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres deplores the rise in the scale and number of attacks against the physical safety of journalists and media workers in recent years. Réal Leblanc is the UN's Chief of Press and External Relations in Geneva. He tells VOA that Guterres warns that world leaders who vilify journalists as purveyors of so-called fake news put the journalists' lives and liberty in danger.
And I think he said on many, many occasions how it's important for all leaders to show respect for the freedom of the press and also show their tolerance and respect for the work that journalists are doing. Freedom of expression and free media are essential to our democracies.
UNESCO, the UN Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, reports 1,360 journalists have been killed since 1993. The non-governmental Press Emblem Campaign reports 65 journalists worldwide have been killed so far this year. In addition, it notes that journalists in many countries are regularly molested, injured, harassed, detained, and prevented from doing their work. The campaign supports the enactment of an international convention for the protection of journalists to combat impunity more effectively. It cites the case of Mexico as a country where impunity is almost total because of the corruption of local authorities. It says most crimes against journalists in other countries, such as Afghanistan, Syria, Somalia, and Iraq, go unpunished because of the lack of an independent judiciary. It argues that independent international investigation and prosecution mechanisms are needed to identify those responsible for these crimes and bring them to justice. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Kenyan half-marathon world record holders Geoffrey Kamrol and Jocelyn Jepkosgei powered to victories in the New York City Marathon on Sunday. AP's Julie Walker has more.
On her first try at the New York City Marathon, a Kenyan runner takes the women's title, while her fellow countryman wins his second men's title in 3 years. Jocelyn Jepkosgei won her debut marathon in 2 hours, 22 minutes, and 38 seconds, beating four-time winner Mary Katani. She holds the world record in the half marathon, but had never run a full until New York. Men's winner Geoffrey Kamara crossed the finish line in 2:08:13, and in a surprise coming in third behind him was Girma Bekele Gebre, who, unlike the elite men's field, ran with no agent, no PR, and no name on his bib, just the number 443. At the New York City Marathon, I'm Julie Walker.
Northern Korean leader Kim Jong-un in April said that he would give the U.S. until the end of the year to become more flexible on nuclear talks. Since then, he's launched 12 rounds of missiles to back up that warning, including a launch on Thursday. So far, though, there is no evidence that the U.S. is changing its stance, meaning that the situation could soon get much more volatile, as VOA's Bill Gao reports from Seoul.
A preview of what may be to come. North Korea on Thursday launched two more missiles, the same multiple rocket launch system it tested in August and September. More evidence Kim Jong-un is serious about his end-of-year deadline for the U.S. to offer more concessions in nuclear talks.
I assume that a huge change will take place next year. That is what I am worrying about right now. In general, there is a big chance things will get worse.
As the end of the year approaches, North Korea's warnings are getting louder. Last month, Kim rode a white horse up his country's tallest mountain, with state media threatening a great operation to strike the world with wonder. Last week, North Korea said Kim's relationship with U.S. President Donald Trump should not be used as a delaying tactic. It also warned that the U.S. is seriously mistaken if it ignores its end-of-year deadline.
If there's no third summit planned or at least a tangible outcome, it's likely that North Korea will conduct nuclear tests or launch an intercontinental ballistic missile.
In recent weeks, North Korea has warned there's no guarantee it won't restart long-range missile or nuclear tests. But Trump, who is dealing with an impeachment inquiry that could threaten his presidency, has given no signs he'll respond to North Korea's deadline. In recent weeks, Trump has barely mentioned North Korea at all. The question is whether Kim Jong-un will soon take bigger steps to get Trump's attention. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Hi, this is Lori London. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts. Every hour, on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook at VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at VOAIE. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter. Our engineer has been Peter Hanley. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Have a great day, everyone.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy.